And it's about 17 seconds after the hour. I'm Ben Brown. Today is Tuesday, the 28th of June. This is a Juno afternoon. Our guest today will include Steve Bowie, who will be talking about the Summer Fun Series with a profile of Glacier Gardens. Christian Andreessen is going to be here talking about Wednesday's folk concert, and Raina Gellert at the Gold Town. We're going to hear about First Friday at the Canvas and have fabric artist Suzanne DeFrancia, this month's featured artist at the Juno Artist Gallery. So stay tuned after National Native News here on a Juno afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Last year's fire season was a brutal one in northeastern Washington. With that in mind, a fireworks ban is set for the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation. Steve Jackson has more.
Colville tribal officials have decided the risk of wildfire is just not worth allowing fireworks on the reservation this year. Fire officials say the fire season is already 3 weeks ahead of schedule, and they're concerned what the hotter temperatures may bring. The ban authorizes tribal police to seize fireworks and also creates an agreement with the Ferry County Sheriff's Office. County Sheriff Ray Maycumber says that he has certified 20 tribal police officers as deputy sheriffs for Ferry County.
I've cross-commissioned them, and as such, they will be authorized to enforce the county's fireworks ordinance on the non-members down on the reservation, because this ban from the tribal council is... It only is for the tribal members.
And that's where the ban gets a bit tricky, because the county fireworks ordinance is not a full ban. The sheriff, from his reading of the ordinance, says that the so-called safe and sane type fireworks, like sparklers, would not be illegal for non-tribal members to use on the reservation. Even so, Sheriff Maycumber says his office will discourage the use of fireworks that create a fire hazard, because that's the intent of both the tribal and county laws. Tribal officials also say they understand the economic impact the decision will have on tribal firework vendors, but had to consider the potential impact on the entire community. The 1.4 million-acre Colville Reservation was part of last year's Okanagan Complex fires and the site of the North Star Fire, two of the largest wildfires in Washington state history. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
An agreement has been reached between the Navajo Nation and the state of Arizona to give tribal veterans better access to services. Historically, on the reservation, there's been a lack of infrastructure for medical and other veterans' benefits. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
The agreement is the first of its kind between a state and an Indian nation. It'll allow the Arizona Department of Veterans Affairs to train and accredit Navajo VA employees to file claims on behalf of tribal veterans. They'll work through offices on the Navajo Nation to expedite services. Navajo Nation President Russell Begay says under the agreement, veterans will no longer have to travel off the reservation to access federal benefits.
Now, with this certification, it opens up the door for more services for veterans. And so anything and everything that's provided for veterans in the state of Arizona will now be provided on Navajo.
Legislation signed into law earlier this year revamped the Navajo VA. It created an advisory council to give veterans more of a say in the tribe's policymaking. The law will also update the Navajo VA's record-keeping system. Authorities estimate there are between 10,000 and 40,000 Navajo veterans, but tribal authorities say for years data collection has been incomplete. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Associated Press reports Arizona State Senator Carlisle Begay has suspended his campaign for Congress. The Navajo man, who jumped in the race in March, cites issues playing catch-up in the crowded run for 1st Congressional District, which now has six candidates after his departure. The former Democrat, who switched political parties last year, represents many rural areas and tribes. CD1's current Congresswoman, Democrat Ann Kirkpatrick, is not seeking re-election as she challenges U.S. Senator John McCain for his seat. The Indian Health Service announced Monday 29 grants totaling more than $7 million will go to urban health programs. The funds are intended to help people living away from tribal communities in a number of states, including Arizona, California, and Wisconsin. According to the IHS, efforts also include boosting services in areas such as substance abuse, immunizations, and mental health. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the 10th Annual Indigenous Soccer Cup July 19th through the 24th. Information on convention and tourism services at CABQ.org. That's SIABQ.org. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And it's 6 minutes and 10 seconds, give or take, after the hour. Today is Tuesday, the 28th of June. I'm Ben Brown. This is a Juneau Afternoon. Before we speak with our first guest, I want to correct the rundown for today. I was actually so excited when I arrived here at the studio. I was telling you who's going to be on tomorrow. So today we're going to be talking very soon here with Katie Harms from DIPAC about DIPAC's Summer Fun Series. Following Katie, we're going to talk to Joe McCabe about his presentation tomorrow here at 360 North. That relates to mining history in Juneau. We're also going to have a preview of this evening's Juneau World Affairs Council presentation with Andy David, the Israeli Consul General, and talk to Derek Grimes, and I believe it's Andy David, sorry if I mispronounced your name, but we're also going to talk to Derek Grimes with Coastal Helicopters about glacier landings and dog sledding, and of course the other features. But first and foremost, let's talk to Katie Harms from DIPAC. Well, let's just see if I'm not certain, and I'm not ringing Katie in, so we're going to listen to Garrison Keillor right now while we figure out how to get Katie on the phone.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 28th of June, 2016. It's the birthday of the man who wrote, "Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains," who believed that modern progress had corrupted rather than improved mankind. In his book on the origin of inequality, he wrote that civilization had led to most of what was wrong with people, that living in a society led to envy, that owning property led to social inequality, possessions led to poverty, and so forth. And who believe that government is unfairly weighted in favor of the rich. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, born in Geneva in 1712, his most famous book was The Social Contract, which had a big effect on the French Revolution. They adopted the slogan from Rousseau, liberty, equality, and fraternity. It was in the early hours of this day in 1969, the Stonewall riots broke out in New York City, in Greenwich Village. The Stonewall Inn was a popular hangout for gays, lesbians, transvestites in the late 60s, and early in the morning on this day, 1969, police raided the bar on the premise that it was selling alcohol without a liquor license. It was the third raid on a gay bar in Greenwich Village in a very short period of time, and this time, when the cops arrived, the patrons did not disperse. They fought back. The police barricaded themselves inside the bar. And in retrospect, it was considered the beginning of the gay rights movement. The first gay pride parades were held on this date in Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and elsewhere. A witness at the time said, "We weren't going to be walking meekly in the night and letting them shove us around. The bottom line was, we weren't going to go away, and we didn't." It's the birthday of Gilda Radner, Detroit, 1946. Moved to Toronto, joined an improv comedy troupe there, Second City, where she met John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, and the three of them became part of the original cast of Saturday Night Live in 1975. It's the birthday of the composer Richard Rodgers, born in New York, 1902, who collaborated with Oscar Hammerstein and Lawrence Hart, with Lawrence Hart on 26 Broadway musicals, including Pal Joey, and with Hammerstein on many others, Oklahoma, South Pacific, The Sound of Music. And it's the birthday of the spy novelist Eric Ambler, London, 1909, author of The Dark Frontier, Passage of Arms, and other books. A friend of his told him, never read very good writers when you are trying yourself to write good trash. You'll only get depressed. Here's a poem by Barry Spax, Looking at a Lizard. My only purpose this moment is looking at a lizard. Does he know he's not alone? He breathes with tiny push-ups, his skin, all hairline caverns, soaking up the sun. I doubt, alive, I'm liable to get closer to timelessness than this, looking at a little lizard breathing. Looking at a Lizard by Barry Spax, from his collection Shaping Water, published by Gunpowder Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Organic Valley, a co-op of family farmers bringing organic half-and-half to America's morning coffee since 1988. Organic Valley, bringing the good. And by Lumosity, brain training with over 50 challenging games, from scientists working with university researchers to push cognitive research forward. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And it is 12 minutes after the hour, 12 and a half minutes after the hour. I'm Ben Brown. Today is Tuesday, the 28th of June. This is a Juno afternoon. And now we are going to speak with Katie Harms at DIPAC about the Summer Fun Series. Katie, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am quite well, thank you. I mean, I'd prefer to be outside, but there's a window in the studio, so it can be worse.
Oh, that's good.
And how are things over at DIPAC?
Oh, they're busy, but good. We have lots of salmon coming back, lots of people to come check them out, but all's well here.
Excellent. Well, tell us about the Summer Fun Series.
Summer Fun. So we right now we're just we have lots of people coming, of course, off the cruise ships, people coming on their own, and then people, locals coming in to check out our aquariums and touch tanks, as well as our fish ladder here. So it's just $5 for people to come inside our visitor center during the summer months, for the adults, and $3 for kids. And that allows you to come in and explore the aquariums. And if you want to hop on a tour to learn about what DIPAC does, that's included in the admissions fee.
Excellent. Well, I think a lot of Junoites have had experiences there for events, for receptions or things like that. But this is kind of a different way to enjoy DIPAC and learn a little bit more about what the actual business of a Douglas Island Pink and Chum Hatchery is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we also offer a deluxe tour. It's kind of offered at random times throughout the day, depending on how busy we are and what's going on with the fish. And that's really cool for locals to check out. And you go behind the scenes and get to know a little bit more of the ins and outs of the science behind what we do.
Well, that's excellent. Now, if people do want to come visit, but then they want to come back, is there any such thing as a membership or a frequent visitor pass, or is it
Yeah, absolutely. We have just a standard one individual pass is $15 for adults and $10 for children. So if they want to come back and look at the aquariums every day, they can do that. As well as if you are expecting a lot of visitors in the summer, we offer a family season pass, and it doesn't necessarily have to be family, but it'll get you and up to four guests in for the whole summer, and that pass will be $45, so covers you the whole summer long.
Oh, so that's certainly the most economical plan right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, again, I think I'm like most Juneau residents probably, where I tend not to go there in the summer because I know it's going to be busy and I'm there for events in the off-season. How busy is it? Like on a six cruise ship day, is it just insanely busy? Or
it can be. It all really depends on how the tours sell that day. But we oftentimes have very, well, we always have a very slow Monday morning, just because there's no ships in town, but we still stick to our business hours. So Monday morning, I know a lot of people work Mondays, but if you're off, Monday from 10 a.m. to noon, we have no buses here. So that's always a really good time to come by. And then Saturdays and Sundays are typically fairly slow for us, too. So those of you that have real weekends, it's a great time to bring your family by to explore everything we have to see.
Well, that's some savvy traveling advice. You know, even for folks who are in town but might have people coming from out of town, that Monday morning slot would be the perfect time to bring them by.
Yeah, absolutely.
So are there any other elements going on for the Summer Fun Series?
We don't have too much else going on right now. We are mostly just sticking to our standard tours, and we're about to start our chum salmon egg and milk collection here in the middle of July. So that's always really cool to see. So we're just kind of sticking to standard protocol this time of year just because it gets a little hectic. But, definitely bringing people by and seeing those fish. And, of course, after hours, checking out the fish ladder is really a great thing to do after work, just getting to see those fish coming in the viewing window. It's full, jam-packed with chum and king salmon right now.
And there are probably some listeners who, you know, just take it for granted that DIPAC is that neat place with the aquariums, out there near the Empire Building. But maybe there are some listeners who would like to know more about its legal structure. I mean, it is an aquaculture association with the nonprofit board, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And the Alaska legislature actually created a statute many years ago to allow nonprofits like DIPAC to get into the business of not farming salmon, that's another real important distinction, but ranching them, you know, just getting them ready to go, but then letting them go out and be natural fish.
Yeah, yep. So we're just raising and releasing salmon here into the wild so that when they're adults, they can be caught by commercial fishermen to kind of offset that fishing pressure on those wild stocks and allow people to keep fishing at a high rate without causing too much damage to the natural environment.
And what species of salmon are actually being farmed there? I used the bad word. I used
you did
the
it.
F word. I'm so sorry, listeners. Forgive me, and I'll never speak of that again. What species of salmon are being raised and hatched there at DIPAC?
So at Macaulay Salmon Hatchery, run by DIPAC, we raise, that's the one in town, is chum, king, and coho. And DIPAC also manages or operates a state-owned hatchery just south of us, Nettisham, and they raise sockeye salmon there. So those of you that are familiar with the Sweetheart Creek release or the Sweetheart Creek return, that's all DIPAC fish that are going back to that terminal fall there. So we raise four of the five species of salmon, all but pink now.
Right, everything but pinks, and, you know, even with the ups and downs, there have been a lot of pinks lately, so that hasn't been one of the problem species.
Yeah.
Excellent. So if people want to learn more about DIPAC, Katie, or maybe they want to learn how to buy one of those passes we were talking about, is there a website that people can go and look at?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually redesigned our website last year, and it's just www.dipac.net.
Excellent. So DIPAC.net, no pun intended.
Nope.
but if you have a net, you might catch a fish. And so great. And so, and is it possible for people to buy the passes there, or do they need to come in and do that in person?
It's actually in person, yeah. We aren't too high-tech here. We're sticking to the stone age of how we sell our passes. So you have to actually come to DIPAC to purchase a pass. Or we could do it over the phone. We could hold it for them. But, the easiest way is just to come by or get the pass when you're here.
Excellent. So it's the Summer Fun Series at DIPAC, Juneau's almost downtown hatchery, and DIPAC.net is the website for folks who want to learn more about things that are happening there. Katie, anything else you'd like to share with our listeners this Juneau afternoon?
Well, I just want to say get out, enjoy the sun, enjoy the fishing, and definitely come check us out.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I hope you have a lot of great visitors as the summer unfolds, and I'll do my best to get out there myself.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Katie. Bye now.
Programming support for this station comes from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. More information at ConocoPhillips.com.
I went to see the doctor. I'd come down with the blues. She said that I can't cure you, but here's something you could do. Take out a piece of paper and go sit down for a while and draw a pretty picture of something that makes you smile. Well, I know what makes me happy. I didn't have to think for long. But when I tried to draw it, it always came out wrong. I had a box of 12, 48, and 64. but nowhere could I find that one shade I was looking for. I guess I realized, should have come as no surprise, Crayola doesn't make a color for your eyes. There is no way that I could possibly describe you. Crayola doesn't make a color to draw my love. At first I thought of green-blue, but then I saw blue-green, and then again in bright light lit aquamarine. I think at night they're darker, I looked again for you, saw gray and black, and went out walking after midnight blue. But hues of the deeper skies would be a compromise. Crayola doesn't make a color for your eyes. There is no way that I could possibly describe you. Crayola doesn't make a color to draw my love. Spring green is much too yellow. Sea green is far too pale. Cornflowers way too mellow. So I'll try again and fail. There's no way I can capture the way you make me feel. One look from you is rapture, whether blue or green or teal. No color qualifies, that crayon's telling lies. Crayola doesn't make a color. Hey, look, it's periwinkle. So sure I got it now. But you wink and there's a twinkle in your eye. And still somehow I just can't get that sparkle. Those glitter crayons won't. Maybe glow in the dark. Get it right, oh no they don't. Mr. Crayola tries, but I'm left to fantasize.
About 22 minutes after the hour. Today is Tuesday, the 22nd of June. I'm Ben Brown. This is a Juno afternoon. And that was Kristen Andreessen, who's going to be performing a Wednesday folk concert at the Gold Town tomorrow with Raina Gellert, a little sample of what you'll hear if you attend that concert tomorrow. And she's also, I think, going to be on a Juno afternoon tomorrow, but not today, like I said at the beginning of the hour. However, on a Juno afternoon today, we now have Matt Miller and Joe McCabe. And
hi.
Joe's here. Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Hello.
Good. How are you?
Very good. And we're going to hear about some of Juno's hidden history and a presentation that will be tomorrow night here at 360. So, Joe, tell us about what you're going to share with folks tomorrow.
Well, I'm one of the co-founders, along with Brian Weed, of Juno's Hidden History. It's a Facebook page we set up about 2 years ago to turn people on to all the hidden history out in their backyards around here in Juno. We travel around, look for old mines and old building sites and all this other stuff that's pretty much on the trail system that anybody could get to or anybody that's a little bit adventurous could get to. And so tomorrow night we're going to do the North 360 North show and talk about all our adventures and mine exploration and all that sort of thing.
Well, there certainly is a lot of it out there. I remember the first time I went up to the Red Mill Trail up off of Perseverance Trail.
Right.
I found a little glass pharmaceutical bottle, and it wasn't broken. And when I came back and I told someone, and I saw the chimney, there's an old chimney stack up there, and I came back and told someone, and that's when they said, you should go look at some pictures. You have no idea how built up that was, you know, 60 years ago.
It's 70, amazing, right?
It really is, but it's just because of the way our rainforest works, the foliage just recaptures things, and as you said, it makes it truly hidden history.
Yeah, one of the things we're trying to do is go out there and document all the stuff that's still remaining with photos and high-res video, so it's there for everybody to see.
And how did you come to be particularly interested in the history of Juno?
I got interested in this through Brian Weed. He was posting a lot of his adventures on the Juno Photo Group Facebook page, and I was looking for something interesting to do, and I hooked up with him. He took me out to one mine called the Lake Creek Adit, which is out by UAS, actually, real easy to get to, and no one knows about it. And since then, we've been buddies, and we created Juno's Hidden History Facebook page to get the word out about hiking and exploration and to educate people about what's out there.
And, of course, the hidden part of it's kind of what's fun, because not every person's going to know that it's there. In fact, just the other day, I went up to Ebner Falls, and Ebner Falls isn't even labeled anymore because I guess they don't want random people from the cruise ships to find it and fall in.
Right.
Which I shouldn't joke about because that happened.
Yes.
There was a couple deaths in the 90s. I don't think there's been anything in this century, but a couple people did manage to fall in up there at the 90s. And back then there was a little rope around it, but it wasn't going to keep anyone really
on the right side
of the waterfall. So there's some perils and pitfalls. So I guess one of the things you're doing is telling people what's out there, but then how to go find it safely.
Right, how to go find it safely, and if you're going to go in a mine, how to enter it safely. We don't recommend you do that, but if you want to do that, wear helmets and what not to touch, what to touch. We'll go through that at the show tomorrow night, what we do for our safety protocols. We even carry air monitors, and we always have a buddy system. Everybody knows where we're going and that sort of thing. So safety is paramount because we don't want to perish in one of those places.
And are you doing – are any of these places, I mean, I imagine some of them are still owned by AALMP. I know a lot of the mining properties were. Are there any sort of private property issues that you address in the presentation?
Oh, yeah, we've run into a lot of those, and we'll address that tomorrow as well. But, yeah, there are a lot of mines on private property, and we do our best not to enter them. We get on the Internet and try to figure out what the property lines are and who owns everything, or sometimes we'll ask permission to try to get into some place if we want to get in there. But right now, yeah, it's a many mines are owned by AALMP.
Mm-hmm. And now that AALMP is no longer locally owned, I'm wondering if there's been any sort of a change in policy about people's access to those, if easements exist from the prior use of the paths to get to them, or have you even looked into some of those issues?
We've looked into some of that issues. We've met with AALMP and Avista Mining and those folks, and they've asked us to stay off their property and stay out of the underground parts of their mines, yeah.
Are there other organizations besides this Facebook page that are involved? I know there's some folks over in Treadwell who for many years have been trying to put some signage up at some of the remnants, because those are some of the most noticeable building remnants over there.
Sure, right off the trail.
And those are there's numbers now. There aren't real signs, but there's a numerical guide, and if you have a little hand list, you can actually go along and read about what each building is over there.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other similar efforts underway anywhere else around town?
I don't know any locally. Brian might, for sure, but I don't know any.
Right. I guess I'm just sort of thinking of the safety issue. I remember going to a theatrical performance over in the Treadwell ruins. And I don't know if it was what building it was. It's two stories, and it's got a lot of concrete and a lot of exposed, sharp metal.
Yes, it does.
And there were three short plays that were staged, and the audience had to follow the performers around. And it was at nighttime. And frankly, it's amazing no one fell in a hole or sliced themselves open on a big piece of sharp iron. I mean, that was my takeaway, you know, because I'd actually been over there hiking during the day.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, so don't go staging a play. And if you're going to, go to Forum at 360 tomorrow night and learn a little bit how to keep yourself.
Learn a little from us first.
Exactly. So tomorrow then, this is, as all events are, open. Doors open at 5 and the show's at 5:30.
That's right.
And it will be recorded and broadcast for posterity.
Yes, it will. And just for those who want to come to and attend, because they're going to be doing some paving out here tomorrow. we're asking everybody to go park over in the Coast Guard subport parking lot for tomorrow night if they want to come and watch.
Right, and anyone who's been following the progress of Whittier Street, they think, oh, I've been able to navigate it. But no, tomorrow is like D-Day for KTOO's parking lot.
Yeah.
There will be no car access, and foot access will require a little bit of dexterity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely plan ahead, park over this. Or if you live downtown, just walk. You know, just walk from wherever you can. If you're within walking distance of KTOO, is probably the easiest thing to do. Well, excellent. It's Juno's Hidden History, and this is really an opportunity for folks who live here to learn more about how to learn more about where they live, because so many people have not really accessed these things in the past.
Right. It's all in your backyard. It's right there.
And any other words of wisdom you'd like to share, Joe or Matt, with our listeners this Juno afternoon?
No, you hit it all there.
Okay, very good. Well, then it's tomorrow. Doors open at 5. Don't delay. Give yourself extra time to get here. It'll start right at 5:30, Juno's Hidden History. Joe McCabe, Matt Miller, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. On a warm, sunny day,
An American robin sits on the ground, its wings outstretched and its tail splayed behind. You look more closely and see that the robin is sitting astride an anthill, and that ants are swarming over its body. Occasionally, the robin even takes an ant in its bill and wipes the ant against the underside of its wings, a kind of avian spa treatment. This behavior, first recorded by John James Audubon in the 1830s, is known as anting. Although observed infrequently, anting has been recorded among more than 250 species of birds. Although most experts agree it has to do with transferring the ant's secretions, particularly formic acid, to the bird's body. It's likely that the ant's formic acid helps control feather mites and other parasites. Lacking ants, some birds have been seen using citrus fruits, mothballs, and even glowing embers to achieve the effects of formic acid. One clever bird, a rook, the British cousin of the American crow, even learned to strike a match, then touch the hot tip to its underwing. Listen to any episode of Bird Note again on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
And it's 31 minutes after the hour. Today is Tuesday, the 28th of June. I'm Ben Brown. This is a Juneau Afternoon. And our next guest is Andy David, who is the Israeli Consul General from the consulate in San Francisco on the west coast of the United States. So welcome very much to Alaska and to a Juneau Afternoon, Andy.
Thank you for having me, Ben. Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here. And I think you're going to have a good crowd at your presentation for the Juneau World Affairs Council this evening.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you've been brought here by Bruce Botello, and he makes a lot of things happen in this town, so I'm sure he will make sure you have a good crowd there. But I think just the nature of your position and the interesting role that you play on behalf of the country of Israel in the United States is going to be draw enough to get people there. We just started talking briefly before we went on the air about your position prior to being Consul General, and you were a civil service policy advisor to the foreign minister of Israel.
Yes, I was a policy advisor. I'm a career diplomat. I'm a civil servant. I'm actually in Israel. A lot of the diplomats, or most of the diplomats, are forbidden to be members of any political party. We don't serve at the will of our politicians. We are professionals.
And Avigdor Lieberman is the current foreign minister?
No, he's now the defense minister.
That's right. But he was the foreign minister in the last iteration of Mr. Netanyahu's cabinet.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
And he's from one of the more right-wing parties, if I'm not mistaken.
He's a right-wing party, yes.
Yes.
A member of the right-wing party. But if people get to know his ideology, is not that far right. I think that he stands for what he believes, but he's supporting the two-state solution. He's supporting an option of, you know, Israel giving up on some of the territories and for the pursuit of peace. He supports Resolution 242, the United Nations resolution, the famous resolution that talks about peace for land or land for peace.
Mm-hmm.
The question that always is in his mind, I think, and I'm not that I'm a spokesman for him, but I would say that he represents a lot of others in Israel, is this the right time for it? Do we have a partner? Is it a reliable partner? Can we isolate ourselves from what's happening around us in the Middle East? Because sometimes, you know, when you have an island in the middle of the ocean affects the island more than the island affects the ocean.
Uh-huh.
And these are questions that I think that a lot of us struggle with, and hopefully we'll find some answers to that.
And I have to confess, you know, I knew Mr. Lieberman's name, but I was not aware that he supported the two-state solution. And if you'd asked me to guess, I would have probably guessed that he did not. Does the Prime Minister, does support the two-state solution?
Yeah, he said that just recently, and when he became Prime Minister on his, first term was back in the late 90s, but and then he went out of office, and then when he returned, the first thing he did was a speech at a university in Israel, the famous, for us it's famous, I guess not everybody here in Alaska knows about it, but the famous Bar Ilan University speech, where he said clearly, one voice, clear voice, he supports a two-state solution. That's the only game in town. Now we need to work to achieve it.
And so the two-state solution, and I shouldn't take for granted that all of our listeners know what that means. I assume that they don't, that means that there would be an Israel and also a state of Palestine.
Right. There'll be an Israel, Palestine. Israel will be the state of the Jewish people. Palestine will be the state of the Palestinian people, living side by side, with respecting each other, with defined borders, with economic ties, collaboration on different issues. You know, mosquitoes and diseases don't know the borders. There's plenty to collaborate on. Agriculture, water issues, which is a huge challenge in our region, energy, anything that two countries, neighboring countries, need to work together on.
And for there to be a two-state solution, really, some other states like Lebanon and Jordan and Egypt, and if Syria can be called a state anymore, if it ever becomes one again, they all have different, lesser roles to play in envisioning that hoped-for peaceful future.
Yeah, well, we have a peace agreement with Egypt. We have one with Jordan. Those were negotiated in the past, and they're still holding. They're holding very strongly. Even with all the turmoil that we experienced in the Middle East, those peace agreements are standing, and they're strong. Hopefully we can reach more of those agreements with other neighbors, but the road is bumpy, and it's not that easy. You mentioned Syria as a state. I don't think Syria will ever be back to what it was. You know, you can turn an egg into an omelet. You cannot turn an omelet back into an egg.
I wouldn't disagree with you, and you know more about it than I do, but I do tend to try to follow those things pretty closely. And I mean, the situation in Syria is very unpleasant and very difficult to be hopeful about. So I guess I would ask, what is the best case that can be hoped for? Is partition enlarging Lebanon? I mean, is there I think a Kurdish state is looking more and more likely with the passage of time.
Well, that depends on Turkey. And Turkey is a major player in the region. And Turkey is opposed to the idea of a Kurdish state. We have to remember that the biggest Kurdish city in the world is Istanbul. There are more Kurds living in Istanbul than any other city in the Middle East. So the Turks are a bit concerned about that. What will be the future of Syria? Honestly, we don't know. Can we affect it? Israel, I don't think Israel can affect the future of Syria. All we can do is make sure that we give humanitarian help to whoever needs it. We established a field hospital in the Golan Heights, which is the border area between Israel and Syria. Injured people, no questions asked, are treated in Israeli hospitals. In worst cases, they're even helicoptered to more central hospitals in Israel. Thousands of Syrians went through those hospitals, and then they go back to their homes and sometimes hiding the fact that they were treated by Israelis, because others will look at them as like they committed an act of treason by allowing Israelis to take care of them. So there's so many players in this. Syria is a mess that just is a result of years and years of mismanagement, corruption, closed societies, in a place where there are sectarian tensions that have been there for centuries, and now the lead, the cap was taken off those sectarian tensions, and just everything, the violence just broke out. It's hard to stop it.
Absolutely. This is not an easy question, but I'm going to ask it. I believe Mr. Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, recently went on a diplomatic visit to Russia, and I think the conventional wisdom in America, at least, is that Bashar al-Assad would not still be hanging on in Syria but for Vladimir Putin and but for Hezbollah and Iran's backing of Hezbollah.
Yeah.
So was there anything positive done when Mr. Netanyahu met with Vladimir Putin to try to – I mean, is Russia really interested in helping the entire region and in helping Israel? And if so, how does that translate into what they're currently doing backing up Assad's regime?
Well, I think like most countries, Russia is interested in helping Russia. And the Russians have a clear interest in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. They have a port that they can dock their ships there, their military ships. It's the only last place that they have in the Mediterranean. They lost their bases in Libya. Actually, that lesson they learned in Libya told them that, as they describe it, that they cannot trust anyone to maintain their interest, so they have to do it for themselves. That's their interest. That's why they're interested in maintaining this regime. The area where those ports are is heavily populated by the Alawites, and the Alawites are the sect or the tribe, if you want, where the president comes from.
Uh-huh.
So keeping the president there means that they can keep their ports.
Uh-huh.
That's their interest. Now, the visit that our prime minister made to Russia, I don't think there are any conspiracies that can be, you know, described there.
But although, I didn't mean to imply that there were. No, I'm just wondering, if I had been in the room, what would I have heard them talking
about?
Yeah,
no, but I'm saying that because many others think that there are.
Right, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, in a region, and they're always worried when we travel somewhere, what are we doing? But we basically wanted to maintain an agreement on the red lines that we have vis-a-vis the Russian involvement in Syria. And when they first came into Syria, you know, when they send their airplanes, the Air Force, when the troops, we wanted to clearly and fast, do it very fast, to send a clear message to the Russians, where are the Israeli red lines? And there are three of those. So the first red line is that we will not tolerate a breach of our borders. That's number one. We will not tolerate Russian jets flying over Israeli territory. And it's important. It was important to make that clear to the Russians, because when it was not made clear, for example, between them and Turkey, a Russian airplane was taken down.
Absolutely.
And it created a lot of mess, which I hear that
Mr. Erdogan just apologized.
Just apologized for that. He understood that he has no other option but to do that. The second red line is that we will not tolerate the transfers of arms from Syria to Hezbollah. And according to foreign sources, Israel has acted on that on multiple occasions to stop those transfers. And, you know, to make it clear to the Russians that it's not against them. It's not against Russia. It's to protect ourselves from Hezbollah.
Uh-huh.
And for the Russians, I mean, sometimes they deny the fact that they're selling those arms. Sometimes we show them the serial numbers, and so it's a conversation. It's an interesting conversation we have with them. And sometimes for the Russians, at the end of the day, it's a commercial issue. So we destroy some of those arms. So they will have to sell them again, and you know, get more income for that.
Uh-huh.
The third red line is, of course, we will not tolerate opening of a new front against Israel from the Golan Heights, from the Syrian side.
Mm-hmm.
This border was quiet since 1973, 1974, and is recently it has not been that quiet. So the message to the Russians is that even if it comes from the Syrian side of the border, but it's attacks on us, we will not tolerate it. And there was one incident months ago where a rocket was launched from, I mean, there was some shooting, you know, across the border, but when they fired a rocket from there towards the Galilee, first time since the 70s, we needed to send a clear message. This is intolerable from our perspective. So Israel and the U.S. are the strongest and closest allies, and the conversation we have with the Russians is to just make clear where our red lines are, what our expectations are, to hear what their expectations, and also to create a mechanism where, for example, there was a mistake made by a Russian jet.
Uh-huh.
So to have a channel of communication which is fast, efficient, so then we communicated, he was returned, it was a mistake, and nothing happen.
Uh-huh.
So we need to maintain that.
And if Tayyip Recep Erdogan had talked to Vladimir Putin before that jet was shot down, maybe that would have been prevented.
Perhaps.
I guess that's what's in mind.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. So
yes.
We call it de-escalation,
mm-hmm.
or we call it, you know, there are many words that we can use for that, and the term is not important. What's important is the facts. The facts are we need to have that open communication in order to prevent miscalculations and misunderstandings.
Very, very wisely stated. Well, I bet you're going to have a great crowd tonight. I could talk to you all afternoon, and I don't actually see my next guest, so we can keep talking for a bit longer. I wanted to ask you, first about settlements. I think one reason many Americans are not aware that Benjamin Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman are really serious about a two-state solution is because we hear so much about the settlements continuing to be built. I've never been to Israel. I would love to go someday.
Right.
So what can you say to people about the level of settlement building and how that's either contributing or detracting from that slow but steady process towards a two-state solution?
Well, this conflict started over 100 years ago, way before Israel was established officially, way before Israel captured the Judea and Samaria. In the past, we had Sinai, and when we had a peace agreement with Sinai, with Egypt, Israel returned Sinai. We offered a few times to return those territories. The first time was immediately after 67, when they were captured. And the answer we got was three no's. No to peace with Israel, no to negotiations with Israel, no settlement with Israel, right? So no recognition of Israel. So since then, we had other efforts under Bill Clinton, and then under George Bush, and then under Obama. So there are many, many times that we said, okay, we're willing to move forward. But it's not about a right-wing government or a left-wing government. Under Yitzhak Rabin, which everybody knows he was a champion for peace and all that, settlements continued to build.
Uh-huh.
The issue is not the settlements. That's a destruction. Yes. We can remove them tomorrow. Yes, it's not easy. We proved that
mm-hmm.
already when we removed settlements from the Gaza Strip in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we do that? Not because we trusted Hamas or we trusted the Palestinians, but because we said, let's try, let's give peace a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer we got was thousands of rockets, terrorist attacks, no peace. No, Gaza did not turn to be Singapore because of us moving out.
Right.
We have to understand the size of Israel. We have to understand the threats. And we also have to understand and remember the United Nations resolution. United Nations resolution after 67, resolution 242, you can look it up, Google it, says two things. One, in the future, Israel will receive security and peace in return for those territories. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So if we are convinced that we can get that security and peace, I don't think the settlements will be a hurdle that we cannot jump over. That's number one. Number two is to also understand that there are political forces in Israel. And Israel is not one voice. Israel is a democracy, is a kicking democracy, is an impatient democracy. We change our leaders much more often than you do here.
Mm-hmm.
We don't wait 4 years most of the time, hardly thinking about two terms. But it's politics. And there are people in Israel who are convinced that we do have the right over those territories. Palestinians never looked or never searched for an independence or independent state in the 19 years that they were under the Jordanian control,
uh-huh.
those territories in the West Bank, Judea and Samaria. It only started when Israel took over. Palestinians never had a state before. They never had a stamp. They never had a passport. They never had a president or prime minister.
Or a currency.
There was no Palestinian entity ever in history, and whoever says the opposite is not saying the truth. But yet, we're saying, okay, things change, things develop. Now there is an entity that we don't want to ignore, we can't ignore, and we want to move forward. The question is, are we going to, for example, unilaterally pull back,
uh-huh.
and then what would happen? We'll get rockets fired at our international airport, in Ben Gurion Airport, which is very, very close to the future borders, if you want, and then we'll be shut down as a country. So imagine your international airports in Alaska tomorrow are shut down because somebody's firing rockets at them. Is that a risk you're willing to take?
Uh-huh.
So we need our guarantees, and we want to move forward. We want to move forward with the right leadership. On our side, their side, and hopefully we'll be able to do that. I don't know when, but I'm hopeful.
Well, you did an outstanding job answering that difficult question, so I'm going to ask you one more. You mentioned of three recent American presidents, and obviously our current president, Barack Obama, a little over a year ago,
mm-hmm.
was successful in getting a a deal through with Iran, allowing Iran to hopefully stop its nuclear weapons program and most of its nuclear program, except for that part that can be pretty clearly verified as for civilian energy-producing purposes. That wasn't a popular thing. The Prime Minister, Mr. Netanyahu, was pretty public about that. And it's been in place for a little over a year now. How does that seem to be going from your perspective? Is it something that Israel can live with going into the future if politics in this country don't elect someone who's going to sweep it away? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to say this. We have tremendous, tremendous respect for the United States, for its leadership, for the Congress, for the White House. And people have to remember that. But even the best friends, even in families, there are sometimes disagreements. The Iran deal is one issue where we disagree. We think that American policies, which were to prevent Iran from becoming nuclear, have changed to containment.
Uh-huh.
We don't think that's a good change. Iran is a country that is looking to be the hegemon in the region. Iran already controls five capitals of other countries. They control Damascus in Syria. They control Beirut in Lebanon. They control Baghdad in Iraq. They control Sana'a in Yemen. And the fifth, if you want, is Gaza through Hamas. They have circled around Israel. They are developing their intercontinental ballistic missiles, which have one purpose. It's not to deliver conventional warheads. It's to deliver nuclear payloads. Now, we are on the same continent as Iran, so why do they need intercontinental ballistic missiles? Who are they directed? They're directed at Europe. They're directed at you. That's who they're threatening. So let's understand the threat first. Now, as far as the deal goes, Iran was allowed to maintain an R&D capability for their centrifuges, for the enrichment program. Iran was not, by this agreement, asked to abandon its enrichment capability. So they're not allowed to stockpile. But what is basically happening by this deal is that maybe an older, more primitive program of enrichment was put aside. Now they're allowed to do their R&D, develop even more efficient centrifuges. And within 10 years, or maybe 15 years, they can rush, they can speed their way to a bomb.
Uh-huh.
10 years, 15 years in the life cycle of a state, of a country, is a blink of an eye.
Uh-huh.
Maybe 10, 15 years is a long time in the life cycle of a presidency. We think that Iran, by enabling Iran to maintain that capability, why do they need to enrich uranium? There are other, I think, maybe 20 countries around the world, including Australia, Canada, mm-hmm. who use nuclear capabilities for energy.
And they could provide that enriched uranium
they
to Iran.
They don't enrich.
Yeah.
No, they don't enrich.
Oh, they're already getting it from other sources.
They're getting it from other sources. Yeah, they don't need to have enrichment capabilities. So if you look at the picture and you say, okay, they're giving the ability to enrich and they're giving the ability to create or develop the intercontinental ballistic missiles to carry that, this combination to us looks like one thing. They have one purpose, and that is to create a nuclear standoff with the West, perhaps with Israel, with others, strategic standoff. And we think the deal allowed them to do that. This is why you oppose the deal.
Well, I'm sure we've not heard the last of it. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to comment on that because I think that's probably one of the most interesting things, not necessarily in a good way, but it's something that we can't ignore. We all need to be thinking about that.
Yeah, and the fact that Iran is going to moderate, if we look at what happened in the last year, for example, the number of executions in Iran has never been higher. The pursuit of gays, the suppression of human rights, nothing has changed inside Iran. So we don't see any positive indicators that now that Iran is off the hook, they are moving towards a direction that we would like to see them moving to. On the contrary, Iran supports more terrorism. Just last week, the head of Hezbollah said that they get all their weapons and their finance from Iran. We all knew that, but now he said it openly.
Mm-hmm.
So Iran is involved in Latin America, involved in Asia, a lot of things that they're doing. So there are a lot of off-Broadway shows that they're involved with. The nuclear program is there on Broadway.
Right, so. Right. Well, I could talk to you all afternoon, but I don't want to have you say everything that you're going to say tonight. So Andy David, the Israeli Consul General, visiting Juneau from San Francisco, he's going to be speaking tonight with the Juneau World Affairs Council. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Ben.
Really good to talk with you, and I would highly encourage anyone listening to go and listen to this man tonight. He's smart and he knows what he's talking about.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No trick to get rich quick if you dig, dig, dig with a shovel or a pick.
In a mine,
in a mine,
in a mine,
in a mine,
where a million diamonds shine. We dig, dig, dig.
And it's just about 4.5 minutes before the hour. I'm Ben Brown, wrapping up a Juneau afternoon this Tuesday, the 28th. And I have a gentleman from Coastal Helicopters. Derek Grimes.
Yep, and then this is Sebastian Schnuel. He's our dog camp leader up at Blue Kennels.
Excellent, Sebastian. Derek, welcome to a Juneau afternoon.
Thanks very much.
Sorry, I went a little bit long with our last guest. So tell us what's going on at Coastal Helicopters and with glacial landings and dog sledding.
So we offer all sorts of tours throughout the summer, and one of the highlights that we have for sure is the dog sledding and helicopter combination. So we take a helicopter flight up to the Herbert Glacier, drop them off at Sebastian's camp up there, and then they get to take a one-hour experience at the dog camp itself where they get to go and do, you know, a dog sledding experience with actual Iditarod dogs and mushers and get that real taste of Alaska.
And it's not just for tourists. Locals can do it too.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, of course. It's kind of fun because, you know, for the tourists, many of them have never even seen snow.
Right.
For the locals, they have seen snow, but it's a whole different world up there. I think few people know how different it is just 15 miles up the glacier.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing like you would ever see here in town.
Especially after the last few winters we've had, where there hasn't been very much snow down here at sea level, I can tell you that.
Plenty of it up there.
Yes, plenty, and all year round, right, even in the middle of the summer. So if people are interested in doing this, how would they go about setting up a tour and learning more about this?
I mean, if you're in town, you can definitely drop by the office. Otherwise, you can give us a call just at 789-5610 or drop by on the website, you know, whatever's most convenient for everybody. Obviously, anybody who's walked around downtown during the summertime sees all the vendors down there. We work with all of them as well to kind of coordinate tours for both the tourists and then for locals as well.
And is this happening every day of the week throughout the summer, or do you have any time off?
Yeah, 7 days a week. We're even working on the 4th of July, I think, for sure, after the parade, of course. But, yeah, anytime that they can come by. We'll be running into August, nearly into September this year. Just kind of depends on the snowpack and how the summer goes.
And where online is there more information about the cost and the timing and the everything that's involved?
Absolutely. You can visit us at www.coastalhelicopters.com, www.bluekennels.com.
Bluekennels.com,
that's
exactly.
Bluekennels.com. And for the online pricing in there, you can take 20% right off the top for any locals that that want to get booked. We go ahead and just do that and you know, try to get as many of them as we can get up there.
Now, I actually had a friend, a fellow attorney associate of mine, Kathleen Frederick, who's a dog musher. She hasn't lived there for 5 years, but she used to go up there and practice when she was trying to practice her teams. Do any people still do that up there?
That's kind of what got me going many years ago, you know, running the Crest and the Iditarod. The dogs need miles in the summer, not just get dusty and fat on the chain. So it's good training for them, and that's what started me. Yeah, I know actually Kathleen.
I'll say you know.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Very
you know.
Good.
Her and Deborah Bignell at the time teamed up together and training together. So mushing is a small world. We all do know each other. She's kind of still having her hands in it, working with some local mushers out of Willow where she lives now.
Right.
So, you know, I think once you have the dog virus, you have it for life.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, Sebastian and Derek, I again apologize for not having more time, but this is a great opportunity. It's a 20% discount for locals. Go to Coastal Helicopters or Blue Dog Kennels.
Blue Kennels.
Blue Kennels, and learn more about this. And, you know, I just have to say it's one of those Juneau things I've never done, so I'm preaching to the choir. I should get out there. Everyone listening should get out there and do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, very much for coming on a Juneau afternoon today, and I hope you get lots of visitors, and we'll see you in the parade, if not sooner.
All right.
Thank
sounds
you.
Good.
All right. Thanks.
Take it easy.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion.